Nationalist with Dr. Matthew Raphael Joseph.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to yet another edition of the Orthodox Nationalist. I apologize to some of my listeners and my producer, Sven Longshanks. My health has been tormenting me, so I haven't been as consistent as I would like to be in making these. So Sven has been very, very patient with me, and I want to publicly thank him for that. That situation is now completed, so it shouldn't be bothering me again. Over the last month or so, something very obnoxious. It's actually more than a couple of years, but for some reason, just over the last couple of months, it's been very obnoxious. And that is how the press, how opinion leaders, so-called policymakers, have characterized Alexander Dugin. Even those who claim in the American universities to specialize in Russian history and philosophy have no idea what this man says. And even if they did, they would not be permitted to state it in a competent way. I am one of the few people on the planet who have read everything that Dugin has ever written, at least the major and even most of the minor works, in the original. That's no easy trick. To do so, you have to have a fairly conversant, fluid knowledge in existentialism, in philosophy of nationalism, Plato and Plotinus specifically, and certainly you have to know your Hegel very well. Schopenhauer and Nietzsche are probably a big plus. And then, carefully, you could pick up some of Dugin's work. Like Hegel, Dugin's one of these people that you have to read everything he writes to understand anything he writes. And he has a well-developed system and is one of the few genuinely original political theorists of this generation. As I've said many times before, and I'll say many times again in the future, that American academia, when it comes to political theory, political philosophy, which is my first discipline, is absolutely stagnant. It's stagnant largely because white males in academia are scared to death. They're afraid of going out on a limb that in some weird way, for some phrase that they may have uttered, be called racist or sexist or anti-Semite. The mere accusation, of course, will destroy their career and render their lives miserable if they stay in academia. And don't think that that university presidents and provosts are not aware of this. What they do, generally speaking, is they overcompensate as a result. You know, white male university professors will then try to out-left the left as much as humanly possible to put them above suspicion. The other strategy is one that I did myself, and that is to be likable and friendly first. And then once they're your friends and your personal friends, you can spring it on them. You know, this is who I really am. You're going to have to deal with it. And they usually do pretty well. Or you could simply leave academia. I've been very lucky, thanks to people like Willis Cardo and many others. I've been able to put together a pretty substantial academic life outside of the university, because it's only outside of the university that you have any real original or interesting political theory. The academy right now is so stagnant, so controlled by big money. These guys are so frightened. They're frightened to say no to any non-white, to any woman especially. The New Nobility, I have a new article out with that title. That overcompensation is a very common tactic. And really silence and stagnation is another. They'll only deal with safe topics and really not go off that particular reservation. Or if they do so, they have to overcompensate or so as to eliminate any possibility of worry. And even there, it's not 100%. And just as American workers cannot ask for anything of substance, they can't ask for raises or anything like that, knowing full well that any large company could simply pack up and leave and do so fairly quickly. Same thing for academics. They know that all it would take is university provost to hire a lesbian student from the Gay and Lesbian Resource Center on campus and say that I was sexually assaulted by him, or I was, the sexist language is all over the place. I was at his house for some reason. I babysit his kids, whatever they want, and destroy his career. The person will never be identified. They'll never have any allowance to confront him. All constitutional protections in those cases, as I've learned myself from personal experience, are thrown out the window, even though these institutions receive federal money and quite a bit of federal money. And so it's completely stagnant, it's uninteresting, and frankly, it's stupid. I believe the results of this is that even in academia itself, people who are supposed to be the most critical, are, your stagnation has the price of atrophy, that these people are mentally atrophied, that they really don't know how to build strong arguments, especially those that are critical. And the last thing they know how to be is free. It's like taking a leopard that's been in a zoo its whole life and sending it out to its natural habitat. You know, it's really a bad idea if you expect the thing to survive. And that's what these people are now. So given all those facts, I'm going to spend this program dealing with aspects of Alexander Dugin's thinking, largely due to the unbelievable level of incompetence and stupidity and self-righteousness of people who are talking about him, including those who agree with me and who I respect in other areas. There's so many prerequisites to understanding him. There's much you have to know. Again, he, like you know, writers at his level, he assumes that his readers are already extremely knowledgeable about Russian history and philosophy, the history of philosophy in general, Platonism, idealism in you know, every sense of the word, realism, nominalism, debates, medieval idea. You know, he assumes this. He can't be explaining himself every sentence. So he assumes that his readers know all of this and know the vocabulary. And since most of his stuff has not been translated, there's very few people who can refute some idiot on TV saying that Alexander Dugin, they'll attach some Western inappropriate label to him, you know, that he's a fascist and a communist at the same time. And they know that they're not going to have anyone really challenge them. And so they could say as they please. And you know, they say stupid things like he's ideological foundation of Putin's reign, that he is the conscience of Russia, stupid things like that. They're really only journalists and media companies could come up with. It's very depressing, though, to hear academics and people I know are getting paid six-figure salaries and have 100% job security going on television and using their alleged expertise in Russian politics to say idiotic things about this guy. So, again, the problem is his catalog is substantial. He's written a tremendous amount at a fairly young age. He's 10 years older than I am. And he's just really getting started. Now, so let's start here. I mean, there's no way I could go through the entire corpus. There's no way I could see the whole system is developing. So what I'll do is, you know, I have my notes on him scattered all over the place, you know, because I would get bored, then I'd go to some other topic, then come back to it again and over the years. So now I have everything spread out in front of me. So let's start from the beginning, and we'll talk about his view of Adam and Eve, which is certainly the beginning. Remember, religiously, Dugin is an old believer. That is to say, he is part of the movement that rejected the modernization of the Tsar Alexis the First, and then not Alexis, Peter the Great, especially, more than anybody else, who centralized and radically altered as a self-described revolutionary Russian life, turning it into a, at least at the elite levels in St. Petersburg, a secular Western empire. So the old believers are far more than just a liturgical movement. Tsar Alexis, as well as the patriarch under his reign, Nikon, had revised the rite of the Russian Church to reflect, to a great extent, the more recently published Greek books. Usually from printing presses in North Italy. And oddly enough, one slight aside here, the first generation or two of old believers were using books from Ukraine and Kiev, calling them Lithuanian books as their standard for the liturgy. So contrary to mythology, it's really not the Ukrainian influence that they were worried about. It was the entire issue of the foreignness of the Greek books, the poor translations there. So it was a liturgical movement. The old believers were strictly liturgical. But there's no question, we'll talk about Dugin's view of this here in a minute, there's no doubt that also was a political, economic, and social movement. So Dugin is a part of the old believer tradition, the strictest of the Russian Orthodox groups, but is under the Moscow Patriarchate. This is a so-called Edinburghian, created by Metropolitan Plato of 19th century Russia. It's a way to bring all believers back to the mainstream church without having them abandon any of their rights. Anyway, so his religious view was very, very clear. Now, the average person talking about this has no idea what an old believer is. So some groups, including some Orthodox groups, you know, would like to, you know, pretend that he's some sort of an occultist or something that they don't understand. And again, there's more stupidity comes flowing out of these people. So his views are strictly Orthodox. There's nothing wrong, as far as I can tell, and nothing I've ever come across suggests that he's anything but strictly Orthodox. However, he is very creative. And Orthodoxy is an eternal truth that always has to be readjusted in the sense that it has to reflect current situation, current issues and current events. Orthodoxy has to speak to it. Adam and Eve represent the synthesis of all mankind. That paradise in Eden existed before there was any dualism. The fall brought the number two into the world. Spirit opposed matter. And truth opposed falsehood, good opposed evil, light opposed darkness. Everything was split into two, and history from that point on, up until the advent of Christ, was constant, long, very painful separation of heaven and earth, which was demonic purpose to begin with. Fall of Lucifer, even before Adam and Eve, created this dualism for the very first time, and Adam and Eve were created not perfect, but innocent. And essentially what happened is that, you know, obviously the concept of the apple is a deeply symbolic notion. There's no apple to discern yourself with. That's, again, it's really almost an infantile literalism. It doesn't even make sense. It is the knowledge of building a civilization. It's the concept of private property. It's the concept of states. It's the concept of classes. These things that people adopt as a fetish. Their status, their ability to desire to dominate others. The knowledge, the foundational knowledge there is what's being spoken of in the Old Testament. It's not an accident that Cain went on to build the city. He is the father of civilization. He created, symbolically speaking, as the human embodiment of darkness. Yes, he certainly existed, but that's not all he was. He wasn't just an individual. He was an intense, deep archetype. The incarnation, Christ taking flesh, unifying the two natures, human and divine, is to finally repair that breach. It's a total break with older ideas and older metaphysics. It was considered impossible prior to the Nativity, and it required God to do it. It was a very intense break in reality, and the result was that only a power of God's level could bring it together in Christ's person. Where taking this broken flesh from his mother, Christ took human nature and all that that implies, human nature, our communication, our politics, our economics, our home life, our marriages, single life, depression, anger, everything else, every culture, language, everything that is human, everything that comes from human nature was joined with the ultimate reality or divinity. And remember, too, that the early debates between the two natures of Christ and how they relate to each other had everything to do with to what extent human nature is connected to the divine. The Synod of Chalcedon settled on a formula that is really the only one that makes sense because the two natures are free. They both have wills, separate wills, but they cooperate freely. And Christ was sort of the driver of these two wills within him, creating a unified, sinless person. The notion of dualism had been repaired, and that reparation exists in the church and only in the church. Now, something that people who know about Dugin refer to quite often is his idea of creationism. It has nothing to do really with God created matter and spirit out of nothing. That's not the issue. By creationism, you're referring to something along the lines of an Islamic submission. Law as this external set of rules that are imposed on people. It can't make sense out of the incarnation. it's actually quite opposed to the incarnation. The concept of creationism is opposed to the notion that it's the human psyche that kind of assembles the reality, the flux of things that are striking it. It isn't so much that there is this to the sinner, to the reprobate, reality is a reality anyway. Reality is something that's already distorted in their mind. So in the cleansing of the mind through ascetic life and the liturgy and study and this kind of a very different life we're called to lead, reality looks different. And in the case of the ascetic, it looks more real. We see more dimensions. We see more more aspects of the light spectrum. We see more reality. No one in the world denies that the average human being sees a tiny little speck of what's out there at any given moment. Spinoza's idea was that there's really only two attributes of substance, thought and matter. But of course, Spinoza also says that the number of attributes is truly unlimited. But we're in such a bad state that we could only see two. What he's referring to is the idea that the creation of heaven and earth is not something important to human beings, because unless we're cleansed through the ascetic life, that won't appear as anything but just what we demand it to be. If we have these appetites, let's say for power, which is very important in story of Adam and Eve in Genesis, then the world will appear as something that is just ready, waiting for us to control it. So our desires project themselves onto the world and they destroy reality. For him, the notion of creationism is essentially an attack on nominalism. It's an attack on the idea that the human psyche is just this entity that acts as a stage, and that reality parades before it through the senses. That's not the case at all. A cardinal principle of orthodoxy, of Christianity here, is that our mind will project its diseases onto the world. The businessman who only cares about profits and the bottom line doesn't see reality. He actually is psychotic, no fault of his own. Reality to him is a projection of his distorted appetites, of the sick system that justifies that kind of thinking. The world appears as nothing but a set of opportunities for profit and a set of pitfalls for loss. Other human beings are seen either as allies of his in this Darwinian struggle or as workers that can be exploited at will. Nothing is real. The point is, if you take the nominalist view, he means creationism as the world as simply a set of rules, brute matter versus our will, our mind. That is far from the case. The truth is that our state of mind is what we think reality is. Now, as I've mentioned already, for Alexander Dugin, the schism between the old believers on the one hand, or we call them the old Orthodox on the one hand, and the system of Nikon, Alexis, and Peter, and the other, is the dominant factor in Russian history. And I happen to agree with him in that respect. What Peter the Great solidified, I think Nikon gets way too much of the blame here. I think he was fooled by these guys coming over from the Middle East claiming to be Greeks. None of these guys were even recognized at home. And there was really no way to verify that at the time. He was tricked. He was told what he wanted to hear by these people claiming to be the Metropolitan of Gaza and these other. The point being is that these Greek sees at the time, we're talking about 17th century now, the middle of the 17th century, desperately needed Russian money. Russia was the only independent Orthodox power in the world at the time. And along with the Cossacks, I should say, the Hetmanate was also independent but much smaller. They required constant Russian influxes of money and diplomatic power, or else they wouldn't exist. So they come to Russia, they're really looking for cash, and they're telling Nikon whatever he wants to hear. And he believes himself to be a student of these phonies who are coming over when he called the Synod to solve the problem of the translation of the books and to slightly alter the liturgy. It ended up being this flood of radical changes in how, not just the specific aspects of the liturgical change, but the attitude towards the faith. It was a true revolution in far more than just liturgical symbolism. The old believers in Dugin's mind are community. The Russian word is subordinos, this idea that neither the individual or the community is dominant. but the community is manifest in the individual, and the individual is brought to his final potential in the community. And within the community, we all have our separate roles, our vocations within that community, our specializations, things that we can contribute to it. Without humility, though, without our limitations of our ego, the community can't work. The central element in any kind of communitarian notion, religion especially, the church is this grace-filled resurrection of Eden, is what, you know, the concept is. You find this in Ephraim of Syria, for example. The notion of the individual, not the person, but the individual, is essential. The individual is ego. It's a distortion. The person is the creation of a community. The person limits himself so that others can take their place. He tries not to be a know-it-all, sticks to the things that he's able to contribute, and that's it. It requires a tremendous amount of restraint and humility. It's the primary virtue. That is what Dugin thinks the Russian church prior to the middle of the 17th century was. And he has every reason to believe that, especially in the Russian north. The Roman Catholic doctrine, the clericalization of Russia, the ability to fetishize the administration, the office of bishop, making a bishop like a little dictator, a little pope, which is still the case in much of the Orthodox world. But the truth is that bishops were not that important prior to this era. Peter the Great gave them almost political powers. They became part of the state apparatus in the sense that it wasn't even so much they had the assignments or anything that they had to carry out. It had more to do with the fact that attitudes were changing. The Westernization meant this kind of creationism in Dugin's sense of the term, whereby laws and rules and power seemed to be something just imposed on others, and you had to obey. If you didn't obey, you were sinful or problematic. This is something that was a real disaster of the new ritual. It was revolution, and it was a revolutionary schism, properly so, in the year 1666, when this was finally signed. And not only was the new rite imposed on the country, but the old rite was anathematized. It wasn't enough that they're imposing a new attitude towards the world on society, but they're forcing the old attitude to go underground. By the beginning of the 19th century, the old believers dominated Russia. Outside of elite circles in the major cities, the peasantry was almost 100% old believer. Dugin stresses that this distinction in Russian history is the clericalism of the Western, you know, new right kind of creationist idea on the one hand, and the idea of the sobor, of the community, manifest in grace and acting as the resurrection of Eden prior to the demonic temptation. On the other, the old belief, the bishop is not that important. The bishop is just one function out of many. He does not rule the church. The Holy Spirit rules the church. The most that a bishop will do is organize the administration of the diocese, which really isn't much work, since if these things aren't taken care of themselves, there's something wrong just to begin with. But the schism led to the creation of a very new kind of local understanding of the church. And the first few generations of the old believers, you had a network of hermitages and very small monasteries, the skete system, throughout Russia, especially in the periphery, because the old belief was then persecuted from there on in. And so they formed a subculture, an Orthodox subculture, that maintained old Russia while Peter the Great and his successors, with some exceptions, was imposing a very alien concept on the nation. There is no distinction between the so-called Josephites and the Transvulgans. That's a separate issue. I have a paper on that on my website. But there are some who claim that the community is not the, you know, very very rigid, very regimented sort of community is dominant in the old believers, and that is simply not true. The first generation, the first couple of generations of the old believers, it was the hermitage and the skete. It was the highly decentralized system of rule that is Christianity to begin with. Centralization is very, very foreign. In the Old Testament, King Solomon centralized all power in the temple, which was ruled over by him. He was involved in international trade with his neighbors, meaning that he was bowing down before idols. Because you sign a treaty back then, you had to bring the idols into the temple. All this for money, all this for power. married a bunch of pagan wives, essentially brought the abomination of desolation refers to the fact that pagan gods, you know, the archetypes of these other societies, demand for money and power over others, were imported into Israel. I still don't know why Solomon is depicted with a halo. It makes no sense. The man died a heretic. He is the absolute lowest that a great society can fall. The opposite is the decentralized kind of life that the old believers were forced to develop in the late 17th century. They always had this notion of the tragic, the apocalyptic in front of them, because they could see in front of their eyes how things were changing for the worse. And it really wasn't until, you know, the very late 19th century that you saw that the elite had abandoned the church almost completely altogether. All kinds of fashionable ideas from the West, these occult things and necromancers and sorcerers became very fashionable amongst the elite. And they weren't even, you know, the elite at the time in Russia were speaking French. Russian was seen to be a peasant language, orthodoxy, a peasant religion. So it was the old believers that kept Russia together. Had the old believers never existed, Russia would be essentially a Western Rite Orthodox country today, almost like an Anglican state, without really much of an ecclesial hierarchy, but everything under the monarch. In a post-royalist world, of course, that would then mean complete anarchy, and Russia probably would not exist. Everything that we know, everything that we love about the Russian church, comes from what the old believers were able to preserve. It's something that Russian nationalists need to accept. Peter the Great was a revolutionary. He was a Bolshevik. He purged the church. He reduced the church to a quarter of its size by the early 1720s. His successors, so to speak, the only legitimate czar and emperor in the 18th century was Elizabeth. They continued this process. Foreigners, Masonic foreigners, Lord Byron, and many others dominated Petersburg. It created this massive schism between the population on the one hand and the monarchy on the other hand, and it was never quite healed. Great rulers like Nicholas I, who actually idolized Peter the Great, it's an unfortunate error of his, but Alexander, but in many other ways, he was a great, great leader. Nicholas I was a great leader, I mean, not Peter. Alexander III, Nicholas II, by then it was too late. They were men of extraordinary integrity, but schism between the common population, peasantry, and the elite, the nobility, the bureaucratic regime, and remember, even then at the time, the seminaries in Russia were using Latin. They were importing everything from the West they possibly could. They had largely abandoned the faith at the elite level. The old belief, and places like, you know, Sarov and Optina maintained the faith to a great extent, many of whom were also, you know, strong supporters of the old belief, a Seraphim of Sarov always was. So we're talking here about something far more than just liturgical distinctions. And your typical writer today, expert in Russian history in the university, is all they'll say. And since they're overwhelmingly secular people who don't know the first thing about Orthodoxy, these experts on Russia end up sounding like halfwits. Unfortunately, they simply can't be trusted. It is, however, and it's one thing I do personally disagree with in Dugin, is that the old belief was a revolt against Kiev. The one thing that Dugin forgets is that, as I mentioned already, the so-called Lithuanian books were the standard for the old Russian ritual, including some books from Kiev. People like St. Peter Molina, adopted scholastic and Western methods and used Latin because they were forced to live under the Polish oligarchy. They simply were mimicking the methods of their masters so that their masters could be convinced. Most of these people don't know what scholasticism is, and it's very irritating. At the same time, Russia, had reduced the church to a shadow of its former self, and had, you know, created this, essentially this foreign elite in the major cities. St. Petersburg was not a Russian city. That was Peter's design. Russian dress was forbidden in St. Petersburg. The beard was forbidden in St. Petersburg. Look at St. Isaac's Cathedral. It's the pagan pantheon. It's a classical structure. you know, from ancient Greece. It's meant to be not an Orthodox temple. It doesn't even look like one. You know, the old believers are those who maintain traditions that today, in 2016, we consider Russian Orthodoxy. They were the only thing that kept the society from destroying Orthodoxy altogether. And it radically changed its form in the 19th century, where a bishop went from being just one function in the community, usually the most irritating one, to a ruler or leader of the church. They just, you know, twisted the whole notion. And, you know, they dropped the iconic notion of what a bishop is, this symbol, this icon of holiness, in the true sense of the word symbol. That was how ruling was understood. It was a measure. The word rule, it had nothing to do with power. You know, power was irrelevant. You know, you bishops and laymen and others, you know, we expound doctrine, we explain doctrine. You follow it or you don't. There's no ruling. There's no leading. That would be irrelevant. Bishops don't rule. They're not meant to. Law is not something that they invent. It's something that they protect at most, and they do that even very poorly. By the end of the 18th century, there was very little canonical order in Russia at all. Peter had tortured to death most bishops in the major cities in Russia by the time he died. And then others, you know, under Lord Byron, and then under what I call the two Annas, and then finally after Elizabeth, the reign of Catherine the Great, the church was reduced to very little. Saint Arseniy Matveyevich of Rostov said when he was sent to be metropolitan of Rostov, which was a new see at the time in Ukraine, that there was nothing there. There were a handful of churches that were empty. There was widespread ignorance. And he learned that most of the Orthodox monastics had fled the country. And they were, you know, either they were at Athos or they were at the Manyavsky in Ukraine, you know, in Austria-Hungary. They had fled the country. So the Bolsheviks, you know, differed only in the sense they had greater access to technology and had a more systematic approach to things. But, you know, the elites in Petersburg were at war with the church throughout much of its existence. And by the time of the revolution, the church was really unrecognizable anyway. It's not to say that it had, you know, violated some notion of, you know, canonical regularity in terms of its doctrine. But that in and of itself is a distortion. You know, the faith is not this set of propositions that we either agree to or we don't. Again, Dugin's concept of creationism with a capital C, it's this nominal idea. There is simply, you know, brute givens out there, objects and situations, and our mind is nothing but a stage, and our senses are the mediator. That's a false view of the world. Law is not something that is imposed on people. It is not something that is legislated. It's not something that gets passed, you know, from some legislator or a monarch. It's something that is revealed by God already as part of Logos. And Christ is the Logos, the inner workings, the essence, the substance of all things and all of their interrelations. The fall of man broke that interconnectedness and created the so-called individual. By itself, the individual is meaningless. It's nothing. It dies. Reality, instead, at its best, at its true foundation, is what Spinoza would mean by substance. It is a singular object of many, many parts. It's a concept of the sobor, of the community in the Russian sense, in Dugin's sense. When Lucifer fell from heaven, and then Adam and Eve fell from grace, fell from innocence, it was puberty in almost every way, and how they viewed the world, even to the point where they had to make clothes for themselves. They were terribly embarrassed, and other people thought of them. And there were other people, of course, but there was this chosen community of Adam and Eve that God had chosen out of the world. And Dugin believes this as well. By the way, that's actually pretty important to him, that there was this chosen people. There's always a chosen people that are held together by grace, by the faith, by the tradition. And these really aren't separate things. But there are the old believers' apocalyptic notion is that Satan is now reclaiming his place as ruler of the world. Christ defeated the devil. He defeated Satan. Satan, the concept, the Hebrew comes from the Egyptian archetype of Set. It's kind of the dark side of technology, where the deviousness rules intelligence rather than being ruled by it or being considered a vice. Satan is the origin, eventually became Hebrew Satan. So Satan was always referred to that archetype, and Set really was Satan. But there's never been any separation there. But the old believer idea, Dugin's idea, the general Orthodox idea, is that modernity was a slow but sure re-demonization of the world, where things were turned into individuals rather than communities. Ego was ruled. Law was something that was imposed on people rather than was uncovered and understood as being part of the human condition itself. It was revolutionary, and Peter the Great was a great part of that. And the old believers had a very strong sense of this. Now I have a book out, Sobornosti, essays on the old believers, some of which are mine, others that I've translated from especially contemporary sources. And it might help get a stronger handle on this kind of thing. But this is the foundational concept of Alexander Dugin, that history prior to Christ is the greater chaotic organization or lack of organization of reality. That nature is no longer seen as this organic interconnectedness of objects, but rather nothing other than a mechanical view that soon will dominate the world in the Western Enlightenment. The Western Enlightenment and the Industrial Revolution came from the colonial empire of the British and their exploitation, whether it be of Ireland or India or Africa. And the surplus created by slavery and exploitation was then plowed into the, you know, formerly Christian England, and created the pagan temples that we call factories, and where thousands upon thousands were killed so that we can have the conveniences that we have today. Now, the old believers, however, and Dugin as well, sees Russians as a chosen people. The notion of the Third Rome is an eschatological concept. It's to gather the believers together in one place. Russia exists as a preparation, or Orthodox Russia, that is. It's a preparation for the Second Coming. Ivan the Terrible, Ivan the Fourth, viewed his reign as a dress rehearsal for how Christians were going to organize themselves against Antichrist. Not realizing that Peter the Great, who was a Freemason, by the way, and a Gnostic, and there's so much proof of that. He was an open Satanist. Remember, Peter the Great wrote hymns to the demons. He had an entire church called the All Unholy Drunken Synod, and he and his friends would have these demonic hymns, and they would sing. There'd be naked women around, and sometimes they'd even get out into the streets and parade naked throughout the cities and attack women and attack churches and everything else. Peter the Great did do this. This is not mythology. He, on his so-called Great Embassy to Western Europe, where he was initiated into the Freemasonry, Peter the Great was seen as this Masonic savior that was to bring Russia, really the only problem, the only, as always, then and now, the only break on the New World Order, international mechanization and egocentric organization of the world, the move from the organic to the mechanical, which is the rule of the demonic. That Russia was seen as the only break on that, and therefore to convert the emperor to their cause would eliminate that. And that's precisely what happened. And again, you know, you had great monarchs of the 19th century, Alexander III and Nicholas II, who recognized this to a great extent. They never accepted the old belief in terms of theology or politics, but they did recognize the idea that Russia had been on the wrong path for a very long time, and had become so Western that it was indistinguishable at the elite levels from any capital of Western Europe. Dostoevsky made fun of this. Gogol made fun of this. The bad French these elites would speak, trying to sound European and abandoning everything that was Russian. By the revolution, there was a great schism between the common population and the monarchy. That's not to say that there weren't great monarchs, that the monarchs didn't do great things. They did. There weren't great saints. Martyr Nicholas II himself is a martyr. It's not to say that. But because of the 18th century, this dark, demonic assault on Russia that lasted for the entire century, there was a permanent schism between the monarch and or the religious realm, bishop, and the common population. And that was manifest in the old belief. Remember, too, that the revolt of Stenka Razin and then Pugachev under Catherine II, and even the Cossack revolts in Polish or Austrian-ruled Ukraine, this was a manifestation. Both the huge revolts, or essentially civil wars, of Stenka regime, and then in the late 18th century, Pugachev. These were old believers. These were nationalists. These were essentially what we would call national anarchists in every sense of the word. And they revolted against this Petersburg new ritual idea, the creationist idea, as Dugin will say. They revolted against this, and their armies were very large. Their armies were very successful. They even had the support of the lower nobility, certainly the lower clergy, the monastics, the common population. And these were great leaders. These were great men. Their people could be quite violent, you know, more so than they needed to be. Nevertheless, these were revolts for old Russia against the new. So Dugin, as well as myself personally, would organize Russian history as the kind of communitarian idea of subordinates. Then the revolt of Peter the Great and his successors, and the failure of the great monarchs like Alexander and Nicholas to try to reverse some of that, without ever moving back to Moscow, without ever accepting the old beliefs or anything else like that. They were in no position to do that. They didn't have the power to do that. And then, of course, the Bolsheviks. Now, we're not going to have time to deal with Dugin's view of the Bolsheviks here, but instead I want to dedicate this to the foundational, fundamental ideas that inform everything else that Dugin believes. Now, what we've done so far is to make one key distinction, that the concept of dualism, the number two, division, you know, the one and the many, these distinctions, came into existence. The fall of Lucifer, the fall of Adam and Eve, in Russia's case, it came in through Peter the Great. Objects weren't interpreted by the mind. People pretended that they existed just in their present state. Well, the ancient Orthodox idea, especially the monastic idea, is that objects are created by us. Our health or lack of health mentally creates the world around us. This is why the notion of creationism is so perverse to Dugin. It isn't so much that we have to worry about God creating things. He certainly did, and he created them out of nothing. But that's just not that important, because our mental state projects itself onto the world. The sinner and the saint don't see the same thing. You can look at the same object, and we don't see the same things. We see very different things. It's important to realize that given our spiritual state, the world around us can go from just a brute piece of matter, and A equals A, the object is just what it is, all the way to being able to see Logos, Christ operating in the natural world, keeping it together, maintaining it as a single organic entity. That depends on our spiritual state. Those unfortunate enough to be born and raised in postmodern America, it's extremely rare anymore, because how we've been hardwired to be able to see the spiritual world functioning in the natural one. Although for the ancients, it's something that they saw as a matter of course. You've noticed that little children could see this. You notice that children have all kinds of views on the natural order that seem odd to us. But the more my own children, when they were younger, the more I see the wisdom there. They're seeing the world the way Adam and Eve saw it, as innocent creatures. The fall of Adam and Eve is what the child goes through in puberty. It's a horrible thing. They were awkward, obsessed with their appearance, separated from God, cut off from the world, trapped in their ego. It's a horrible time. Puberty is something that, it's a mimic in almost every particular of the fall of Adam and Eve. The very fact that they had to sew these fig leaves together and clothing, the adolescent obsession with appearance and clothing, is just one of these many details. That is something that history has been up until the incarnation. Russia, then and now, is the only thing that is maintaining the truth in the world. Dugin will say, and I will say, that when Russia goes, there is no place to hide. That will be it. Satan will rule openly and completely. There'll be no challenge to his power. If there's no challenge to his power, there's no reason to hide. And Satan will come out as the ruler of the world, the new world order, capitalism, communism, of nominalism, of ecumenism, of the egocentrism. At the moment, because Russia exists, and by Russia, we're not just referring to the nation, but to the civilization. Dostoevsky and Gogol, as well as Solzhenitsyn, Russian is an Orthodox person whose approach to the faith comes from old Russia. So I would be a Russian under that definition, but Lenin would not be. So Russia is a civilization, it's a faith. It is the final kingdom. The temple, the way that the Orthodox Church, the actual church itself, is organized, is supposed to reflect this. The nave is this large section, the main section of the church, where the congregation stands. This is the realm of angels. This is a realm of created spirits. Spirits that, one of the things that typifies spirit is that it never sees the individual thing. It always sees the archetype first, and then the individual as participating in it, secondly. Then the narthex is the entryway, and that is really for those outside of the church. That's where the catechumens go. It's almost a little church in and of itself. In America, the narthex has largely been eliminated. It's just this, you know, section. There's some literature back there, and most of them, people don't even realize what it's supposed to be. It's the lower waters, so to speak. It's formed matter. It's just one step above nothingness. It is those who are outside of the church are almost exiled there until they're brought back in. Now, the iconostas is the meeting of the two worlds. It is not a dividing line at all. It's, in fact, a window. It's the dividing line between the uncreated and created. And the altar itself is the manifestation. It's God the Father. It is the uncreated principle, something that contains no matter at all. Be careful. Something that Seraphim Rose said stuck with me from one of the first Orthodox writers I ever read. Don't think of this modern kind of Cartesian idea that there's spiritual things and then there's physical things. Reality is that the spiritual realm and the physical realm is a spectrum. And there's infinite amounts of gradations there. And the more we become ascetics, the more we separate ourselves from the world and power structure, the more we'll be able to see this. And not just see thought as somehow identical to spirit. It is not. And the church is meant to be organized this way. The iconostas is where our fallen human nature, our, as people, as individuals in the narthex, in the nave, we're looking up at the altar, but we really can't wrap our brain around it. We're not capable of seeing that which is uncreated. We don't have that capacity. We're on our way to be doing that. We are being formed as that. The iconostas is the kind of the buffer between the two. So he thinks of it like this. Life starts out as, you know, after the fall, as passion and appetite, power, brute matter, facing the individual, the ego. Then life as an ethical truth. This is where rules like the Ten Commandments are laid out. You can either obey them or not. But then that is turned into the life as spirit. This is the change in our perception that comes from ascetic transformation. Again, the ascetic life slowly removes these obsessions, fetishes that the power hungry have, that Adam and Eve were tricked into believing was real. People are afraid of dying. They're afraid of suffering. And therefore, they seek to control others, to try to carve out fortresses in the world for themselves. And it's this constant development in history since the incarnation. It's the structure of the church. It's the structure of Russian history as well. And the purpose here is that spirit and that life will only be fully manifest to the remnant after the war between Christ and Antichrist, which Russia is a central battleground, and Russia is the manifestation of the Christian ideal in politics and economics, as well as in theology. And this is something that the old believers really took as essential, that this is Russia's role. It is a restrainer in the sense that it keeps Antichrist from ruling the world and thereby taking off its mask. The story of Melchizedek in the Old Testament is a hint as to where history is going. Melchizedek is Christ. He's God. He is manifestation of the priestly order. Christ is the ultimate sacrifice. He has no parents, so he's uncreated. Abraham offered him a sacrifice. Melchizedek is Christ. He is completely alien to this world. At the time, only Abraham was able to recognize him, really recognize him for who he was. Melchizedek is just the first introduction of Christ as a person in the world, completely alien to it. The process of decay and degradation was well advanced. And he's hinting to the people at the time and people who are reading this, of course, you know, centuries later, that things will change, that things will improve, and that the life of Eden will return. This distinction between manifestationism and creationism is the key one here. Manifestationism is this idea of the cleansing of the mind. Melchizedek is a hint for people at the time, as well as ourselves, of what it would be like to be Logos in a world that couldn't even begin to comprehend what Logos is. It is Christ existing in the fallen world as Logos. The Magi, the Persians, had a very dim grasp of this notion. Mother of God is the house of God. It's the church itself. It's the free nature, like the iconostasis, the border between two worlds. Now, Lucifer, on the other hand, is the fallen order. It's the physical deterministic order. Nothing but cause and effect is mechanism. Viewing the organic as if it's mechanistic is the most intense sin against philosophy. It's one of the most distorted perversions, almost the most severe mental illness, that you impose that cause and effect, that mindless, meaningless machine, believing that everything is that, nothing but one large machine with no purpose, that eventually will run out of energy for no reason and will simply die at some future date. That is the demonic order. That is New World Order. That is exactly how you are meant to view the world. Anything else, according to the regime, is nothing more than superstition. And the concept of devil comes in the Hebrew from an earlier Egyptian, from crushing, separating. It takes the person out of the community, out of the organic, and artificially separates him, calling him an ego, an individual. Now, this is something to be celebrated. But it's, of course, a contradiction. We can't talk about meaning and spirit within a mechanistic system. There's no purpose at all, and your life is meaningless if you believe in stupid crap. That's all a machine is. A machine is unconscious. You could destroy a machine if you want, no different than destroying a human being, if that's all we are. The killing and would have really have no purpose, but there also be nothing wrong with it either. The devil is that which separates, that removes the individual from the community. It's the creation of the nominal. Set, as I mentioned before, the origin of the word Satan, is this. It's the obstacle. It's the hedge. It's the belief that if we just have the small oligarchy that knows how to manipulate the cause and effect material world, they will then come to rule it. And for all of this, Satan has one target, and that is Russia. The Orthodox Church is led by Russia, politically speaking, only because she's so large. Do you ever wonder, and think of it like this, we live in an age, any scientific approach to the world is based on this kind of exactitude, this idea that everything has to be placed in mathematical form, and this is the nature of how things are proven or not proven. And everything in the world is supposed to be turned into this mechanistic system with numbers and the mathematical methods as its fundament, its fundamental foundation, except ethics. The minute you start talking about how people behave and how they behave, all of a sudden, it's anything goes. Everything else in the world, everything else in existence, is in the modern world based on this exacting mathematical standard. Everything but how the elite behave, how people behave. All of a sudden, suddenly, and it's the only area of life where this is the case. Suddenly, this exactitude goes flying out the window. That just for some reason, that the positivist, the nominalist could never explain, ethics is the one area that seems to be randomly left out of everything else, which is very exacting and rigorous. And of course, the obvious answer to that is because you're dealing with how the elite behave. They cannot be bothered by these ethical concerns. So it's the one area of the so-called scientific world that is completely outside of the mathematical system. Everything else is amenable to this kind of proof, and truth is easily available through the proper methods, except how we behave. the final end here is Dugin would call Hyperborea, Siberia, as the center of the world. Siberia, the center of Eurasia, the Aryan capital of the north. It means the land of the wild boar. All civilizations in the past have had a concept of this white northern area. At the same time, even the steppe, which is sort of the so-called southern tundra, what used to be called by the Turkic peoples who lived there in prior to the Middle Ages, the home of the gods. The concept of Rus here, it comes from the red, the Russian word for red and beautiful. The word beautiful and the word term red are one and the same. And the Turkish tribes, the nomads from that area, had spread veneration for the Russian Tsar. Many don't realize that the 13th Dalai Lama believed that the Tsar of Russia will be the protection of Tibet against the British, that it had been, the Tsar had been prophesied, the Hyperborea of the birthplace of the gods, the north, Apollo, the solar gods, all come from this northern part of the world. Capitals, it is the absolute capital of reason, that this is going to be the salvation of Tibet. And it was done as part of a war against the opposing power, that is Great Britain and international mercantilism. Now that has passed to the United States. Siberia is the home of the gods. It's the home of reason. It's the solar area. It's the place of light and repose. That is the end. And the victory of one over the other is already assured in Christ. How that's going to manifest itself is another matter. Nothing is guaranteed in the sense that there is no mathematical timetable that anyone could understand. That's not how numbers were used in the ancient world anyway. They were doing all these mathematical formulas, using numbers in the Bible, is a sign that the person doesn't know what they're doing, because numbers were not quantitative entities. Even the word Rurik, in the first royal line of Russia, it was a falcon. The celestial orientation is really the origin of the word Rurik. And for him, the Norse Svar, S-V-A-R, is the origin of the word Tsar. It is not a mispronunciation of Caesar. That doesn't make any sense anyway. Caesar was a secondary title. Caesar and emperor were not the same thing. Especially in the reforms of Diocletian, there were four Caesars. So it would make no sense for a emperor of Russia, the final eschatological Christian kingdom in the world, to call himself a lesser title using the word Caesar or Tsar. It's not. It comes from the Norse Svar. It comes from this Hyperborean, Siberian world. The Tsar is a sacred figure. It's a religious figure, not a secular figure. So what is the issue here? I've dealt with some more abstract philosophical topics here, because this is the foundation of the two empires, that of Great Britain and America on the one side, based on the ego, profit, industry, nominalism, against the land empire, Eurasia, with its center in Siberia or Hyperborea, the land of the solar god, or the solar archetypes, based on hierarchy, certainly not of money or class, in the sense that Marxists would use the term. Class refers to behavior and responsibilities, having nothing to do with income. Income is just what you need to do, what you need to have, I should say, that you can perform your duties. It's not a good in and of itself. It's so you have what you need in order to perform your particular role in the community. And, of course, Russia and Eurasia is the representation of that, and the former represented by the United States, especially cities like New York. Two irreconcilable points of view. And that this is world history. The demonic is the American, is New York, the individualist, the Judaic, the profit-seeking, the scientific in the vulgar sense of the word. And yet Christ will finally have his archetypal origin, not his origin on earth, of course, as the final synthesis of the previous archetypes of Northern Europe, especially Hyperborea and Siberia. That is the heart of Eurasia and will be the hammer of Christ against the New World Order. The New World Order is the demonic Asetian, Luciferian, Promethean, the titans of industry. The concept of the titan is an archetype. Those who rule in the same way that the British Empire ruled, through fraud, through deceit, through manipulation. That is the essence of what Dugin believed. I've been speaking now for an hour. I know some of this stuff for neophytes must be terribly confusing and abstract and weird. And that's okay. For you to realize that should be, if you're interested in pursuing this further, to contact me or to begin pursuing this slowly but surely, that these things, which I've very, very rapidly summarized here, start making more and more sense. And once you grasp it, you'll start realizing that this, in fact, is true. And this has been the absolute foundation of world history. And the final war coming between Christ and Antichrist, with Russia, of course, being the restrainer against Antichrist. So contact me if you want to pursue this further, one-on-one. I have no problem with that. It's extremely important. And needless to say, you're not going to get this on the nightly news or from Tim Russert and these other idiots. God knows, not from your professors at universities, which are really is just Satan's sick joke in the world. Anyway, thank you for listening, as always, to my friends. I appreciate very much. Sven Longshanks, you've been long-suffering here and a very good producer. To my enemies, you're idiots, you're stupid. You know that you've sold your soul for the sake of some comforts. But I also do appreciate that you do keep me on my toes. You know, if you have a problem with me, contact me, which none of you ever do, because you know how unpleasant it's going to be for you when you do. If you want to criticize me, contact me directly. You certainly could write and speak to me in a respectful tone and disagree vehemently, and you will get an intelligent response to the extent that I understand what you're saying. You could just be an idiot and go on these forums and call me names and stuff like that. And, you know, you're beneath me. But for people who don't understand, who are critical, contact me directly, please, and you will get a respectful response. So for both people, both my enemies and my friends, I thank you both, although for very different reasons. This is Matthew Raphael Johnson, the Orthodox Nationalist, and I'll be talking to you next time. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to The Orthodox Nationalist with Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson at Radio Aryan.com.